sort of come to my mind as a way of review, and yesterday I read the quote from Faulkner that I thought expressed very well what Tolkien would like to say that he was doing in his books. I've also got here some brief quotes from Tolkien from his essay, which was originally a lecture on called On Fairy Tales, in which he truly explains himself. And this is some of what he says about what he is about. He's talking about the consolation of fairy tales. He talks about what fairy tales are for, and very much addresses, incidentally, the question of whether the accusation that fairy tales are escapism. And he maintains that fairy tales are not escapism, but that we become immersed, that through the fairy tales we become immersed in our world rather than escaping from it. And this is what he sees their purpose as. And here he's speaking of fairy tales as consolation and the happy ending. He describes a sudden joyous turn in fairy tales, a sudden and miraculous grace, never to be counted on to recur. Sorrow and failure remain, the possibility of which is necessary to the joy of deliverance. But it denies, in the face of much evidence, I think we were talking about that a little bit this morning, in the face of much evidence, the universal final defeat. It is an evangelium, if I'm pronouncing that right, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of the world, poignant as grief. When the sudden turn comes, we get a piercing glimpse of joy and heart's desire that for a moment passes outside of the frame, rends indeed the very web of the story, and lets a gleam come through, a sudden glimpse of underlying reality of truth, a far-off gleam or echo of the good news in the real world. Christian joy is infinitely high and joyous, he concludes. The story is supreme and true. Art and fantasy, the art of fantasy turns out to be truth. History and legend meet and are fused. And that is what he saw himself as about when he wrote fantasy, which he was willing to accept that title for what he did, but he was perfectly willing also to accept and used as his self-description that he wrote fairy stories. And, so he was happy with that. Yesterday we used Hobbiton and the hobbits as little ones as an example of what perhaps God's intention in creation, their harmony with the earth, their harmony with one another, their sense of community, and that in strong contrast to the corrupted wizard Saruman, who now, instead of community, is exploiting, I guess is a word we can use, and just using things up, consuming them to the point of extinction and destruction. And all of the descriptions also of Isengard and of Mordor in the book are descriptions of industrial waste, an industrial wasteland. And all of the descriptions fit that. So we had that contrast then, and when we contrasted the look on Saruman's face, the art of the actor here, and saw the person playing Saruman did such a perfect job of conveying the power and the arrogance of power and domination and control and sheer power, and in contrast then to the art of the actor with the hobbits and the contrasting their faces in the final scene when they had a chance to experience power but instead experienced confusion, humility, and just almost a fear of that. And we didn't get to a final scene, and I know, Jeannie, you used that word, the humility that was in their faces. And this final scene we didn't get to last week either, so I thought we'd better play it and see where it leads us today. So the first, this was to be the last scene yesterday.
We go right.
Before great
famine.
Before
we drive him mad.
So do all who live to see such time, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us. There are other forces that work in this world for you besides the living. Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you also were meant to have it. And that is the courage you thought.
Kind of a transitional piece there. It gets the heart of what the humility might be about in that scene. What would you say, what would be the reason for humility?
You got to help for just a minute here. Was that Elrond talking to him?
No, that was Gandalf.
That was Gandalf talking.
Yes.
Okay, I've it's been a while since I've...
Gandalf speaking. Right. Yeah. Isn't Ian McKellen wonderful? He's just amazing. So what would you say there would be the reason for approaching the world with humility instead of the arrogance that we saw in Saruman, who wanted to control everything and dictate and everything?
We aren't in control.
We aren't in control, yeah. Right. What else? Even the wise?
Like,
yes.
We may never know who the instrument of good might be.
Yeah, yeah. We can't see the ends.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what might be the instrument of good. It's the folly of the cross that Paul talks about, isn't it? You know, the cross is folly. To anyone on from the outside looking in, the cross looks like folly. And that the wisdom of the world is not the wisdom of God. And I felt that scene also perhaps might have picked up on some of those concerns about where is God in this? God is definitely there. We could argue about some of the theology in there, but that's another subject for another day. There's some theology in there I'd really like to argue with. But anyway, but the humility, because we do not as humans see all ends. We go into this, we go into what we're doing in that prayer. Robert, get up and read the prayer we had this morning, okay?
My task.
This is what's called the Holden Prayer. God, you have called your servants to ventures of which we cannot see the ending, by paths as yet untrodden, through perils unknown. Give us faith to go out with good courage, not knowing where we go, but only that your hand is leading us and your love supporting us. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
So, come on in. So, even the wise do not see all ends. We do not see where it is going. I had a favorite hymn that had been left out of the last two prayer books. I mean, last two hymn books, so I had to find this one. And it is one that I think may have easily been in Tolkien's mind, because the school he attended in Birmingham for his secondary school was founded by Cardinal Newman, and this hymn was written by Cardinal Newman. I've lost my place. What happened to it? Anyway, I pretty well know it. Lead kindly light, who can help me out amid encircling gloom? Lead thou me on. The night is dark and I am far from home. Lead thou me on. Lead thou my feet. I do not ask to see the distant scene. One step enough for me. So that's the basis of the humility in this, that we do not see the steps ahead. We do not see all the way. And in the book, and the Council of Elrond is cut very short in the movie, like all of the discussion in the book. And they're talking about the folly of this idea of destroying the ring against the human wisdom of, we've been given some power, it's fallen into our hands, it's a gift, let's use it, you know. And but they turn instead to the way of folly. And Gandalf says this, "Despair or folly," said Gandalf, "it is not despair. For despair is only for those who see the end beyond all doubt. We do not. It is wisdom to recognize necessity when all other courses have been weighed. though as folly it may appear to those who cling to false hopes. Well, let folly be our cloak, a veil before the very eyes of the enemy, for he is very wise, and weighs all things to a nicety in the scales of his malice. But the only measure that he knows is desire, desire for power, and so he judges all hearts. Into his heart the thought will not enter that any would refuse it, and that having the ring we might seek to destroy it. So this folly then, folly it appears to the world, is the wisdom of God. And so any thoughts or comments on that? And that, of course, is the basis of our humility as Christians and in accepting one another, even when we do not agree, is that we don't know. We cannot have certainty. And so that's very strong in Tolkien's idea. Now, I mentioned yesterday briefly that there was, having used the hobbits as an example of the good life that God might have intended in creation, I mentioned that there was a downside, and it somewhat relates to this. Anybody see what the downside of the hobbits might be? Their way of life?
Sloth.
Sloth, yes, yes. There is certainly that possibility. What other deadly sins can we come up with here? Yes. Sloth, yes.
Mm-hmm. We're just too comfortable. They don't want to venture out and go anywhere.
Absolutely. They don't want to journey at all. I mean, going on a trip, it's so inconvenient, you know. So they are some phrases from the book used to describe hobbits, in spite of my glowing description of them on yesterday's title. Okay. That we would find their history book exceedingly dull, Tolkien says. Hobbits, though, delight in such things, if they were accurate. They like to have books filled with things they already knew, set out fair and square with no contradictions. Anybody else's religion sound a little bit like that sometimes? Okay. And let's see, this other one. Well, when Bilbo begins his speech in the book, it's well portrayed in the movie. It's the beginning of Bilbo's speech, and everybody's shouting, hooray, hooray, many happy returns, they shouted, and they hammered joyously on the tables. Bilbo was doing splendidly, they thought. This was the sort of stuff they liked, short and obvious. the hobbits need something more than this beautiful good life. And that is what we get to today. We are called not just, you know, into that peace and contentment and abundance and all of that. We are called to do something. So let's have the opening scene to give us the... What else?
Majestic.
Huh?
Majestic.
It was majestic. You know, the epic is beginning. Yes, it was majestic.
Something's epic. Going to happen.
Yes, yes. and we talked about this morning. You know, honestly, both of the sessions I were in this morning, we could put them all together at this because it's all there. And the journey of life that we talked about, the possibilities, and then Terry, the journey that Abraham and Sarah are called to, which we're going to get to in a minute too, and all of that, the majestic possibility of it all of this opening out, something is about to happen, something is about to begin, and anything else that you felt with that?
It makes me feel like running down an open road.
Yeah. Right, yeah, it does. I mean, how we all sat still in the theater when we first saw that instead of leaping to our feet, I don't know. But yeah, it magnificently captured that. Then you just want to get up and go. Well, the reason for this is I think, well, the reason or connection is that that is a universal human motif, isn't it? The idea of the journey and the hero's journey and all of our journeys in life, that we are all on a journey of some description into something new, into new possibilities, into a new way of life, into what we are called to do. And in this book, there is this journey of vocation, and also the sense that was in that last scene that was talked about a lot this morning, of being elected for this, being chosen to do something, called to do something, called to go out, called to a new purpose. And so that sense of the hero's journey, that sense of the epic is common throughout humanity. What other books about great journeys do you think of that might inspire you to this? The rest of you, seen or maybe movies or whatever. The journey. Did
the
I refer
Odyssey.
To
huh?
The Odyssey. The Odyssey, yes, yes, of course. That's the prototypical one, I suppose. Pilgrim's Progress, there's a journey.
Huck Finn.
Huh?
Huck Finn.
Huck Finn, yeah. Yeah, the journey, yes. It's another one, yeah. The territory ahead. That sense that there's something else out there, you know, and that's what the hobbits by and large turn their backs on. So we've got now this election, this vocation, this being called out to do something new and something different.
Truman Show.
Huh?
Truman Show.
The Truman Show, yes, yeah. That was a good one. And that sense he always had, there's something else, you know. And if we don't live our lives with that sense of there's something more, something beyond me, something more than this, we're very deprived, I think, if we don't live with that constant sense of what am I being called out to. And there's spiritual landscapes, aren't they? Maybe some of you could talk about that. There are landscapes that make you feel that way. Spiritual landscapes. Many people find Holden Village in spiritual landscape, that idea of a spiritual high. Personally, mine's the desert, but for many, it's Holden Village. So any other comments on that?
I was struck in that clip, Jan, with the faces.
Yes.
And
how
it was brilliantly directed, I think, because each face had a very different expression, and none of them looked terribly comfortable.
Yeah.
But you could see the different personality, mm-hmm. in some sense, the different quality of call,
mm-hmm.
And of vocation and story,
yes.
in each of their faces as they round that, that crest and head out. And it was wonderful to see that again.
Yeah, it's a magnificent scene. It really is. Yeah. Anyway, well, let's go now to some examples of people receiving and experiencing call.
Stay in the Shire.
No. No, it can't.
Must I do?
You must leave and be acquitted.
Where? Where do I go?
Get out of the Shire. Leave the village to breathe.
Breathe. What about you?
I'll be waiting for you at the Inn of the Prancing Pony.
And the ring will be safe there.
I must see the head of my order. He is both wise and powerful. Trust me, Frodo. You'll know what to do. You'll have to leave the name of baggage behind you. But that name is not safe outside the Shire. Travel only by day. Stay off the road.
I can go across country, isn't it?
humans really are amazing creatures. You can learn all that there is to know about that person in months, and yet after 100 years, they can still surprise you.
Okay, there's somebody heading out on the journey. There's an awful lot going on in that scene. Among other things, there's some scriptural echoes there. Did anybody pick up some of them? What scenes in scripture did you think of? Yes.
Jesus in the desert being tempted.
Absolutely. Yeah, very, very much so. Gandalf turning his back on a way of getting to where they want to get to and rejecting that way. And certainly Jesus facing the tempter. There's another place in the Bible that reminded me even, I think of even more strongly when I see that scene of Jesus rejecting that temptation to do it the wrong way. Where is that scene?
To leave the cross.
Yes, but and specifically...
At the garden.
Well, there's certainly the garden. But one other where someone offers him another alternative and he says... Get behind me, Satan. Remember Peter saying, no, it's not going to be that way, Jesus. You're not going to do it that way. That's not the way to go about this. And Jesus rejected to get behind me, Satan, rejecting that temptation to another way, a shortcut, perhaps, of getting to where they need to go. So, yeah, very strong overtones of that in Gandalf there. And what other echoes did you pick up? There was one almost direct quotation from the New Testament. Let me pick it up. Where some people are setting out on a new identity and a new way of being in the world. What then must I do? It was the question of the people when they went to John for baptism. And having been baptized now in preparation for this new way of being in the world that is coming on them, they ask the question, well, what then must I do? And that needs to be each of our question, each and every day in light of our baptism. What then in the world, what then must I do? And that was Frodo's question there. And so what then were the consequences of that question? What changed in his life that might be symbolic of the going out into a new vocation? What changed? Did you pick up some of the things?
Well, he didn't leave his old name or reject his... He couldn't go out with his name.
Yeah, okay. He no longer... His name changed, just like Abraham and Sarah. From Abram and Sarai to Abraham and Sarah. A new vocation, a new calling in the world, a new way of being. And each of us in our baptism receive a new name, our true identity, our true name. That we receive in baptism, we set out and we are ordained to a new vocation in the world. So yes, he had to leave his old name behind. What else did he leave? Yes.
Well, it seems like every time he gets to where he's supposed to go, he's told he has to go farther.
Yeah.
He gets to the Prancing Pony, has to go to Rivendell.
Yeah.
Gets to Rivendell, has to go
has
to Mantua.
Go on. Yeah. Even though I do not know the way. I just love that. You know, that's in the book too. He does not know the way. Yeah, and so it's always... you know, the book of the Gospel of Mark, my favorite, ends with, he is going ahead of you to Galilee. Mm-hmm. And that is the life of faith, and this is the life of faith we see echoed here in The Lord of the Rings, that it's always out there ahead. What did you say, living into, one of you said something about living into, leaning into the future. Wasn't that your phrase this morning, Terry? Yeah. So this is a good example of that, leaning into the future. And so it's always out there ahead. So he leaves his name behind. He leaves his identity and his home behind. What does Jesus call us all to do? Take up your cross and follow me. Look, Lord, they say his disciples, we have left all to follow thee. And they don't exactly do it too perfectly in a lot of places, but sometimes they do indeed leave everything to follow. So he's leaving everything behind. And there's a scene much later in the movie where, and do we... Yes, was there something, John?
Yeah, well, this might be a stretch, but Tolkien resented Catholicism, right?
Uh-huh.
And then we have Gandalf, who is going to speak to his higher order.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And then it turns out that his higher order, the hierarchy, is corrupt.
Corrupt.
Spoiler.
Yeah. Whoa, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, one can think of a lot of things in connection with that. Yeah, that he goes to the old, trust me, he'll know what to do. So, that's wonderful. I love it. So, yeah. Right. So then we're leaving everything behind then. And going out on ventures of which we cannot see the ending, and sometimes our leadership is a little suspect, you know, and it's a little difficult. So any other thoughts about what you saw happening there in that scene, this new vocation? Yes?
Well, I just really like that Frodo asked the question after this kind of silence. No one said, Gandalf didn't say, I can't do it, you have to. He ended with, like, I can't do it. And you could see Frodo's face change, and there was no prompting. He just knew himself.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that suddenly that call to do it, and he knew it. Yeah, yeah. And that sudden certainty of that call to do something. Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Not many of us get that certainty. And we generally, by and large, take many years to sort out vocations. Whatever that vocation may be, it takes many years and an awful lot of stressing and straining and resistance and pull and all of that. Okay, there's another scene here I want you to see, and then after that maybe we can even go further into this.
Dangerous business, Frodo, going out your door. You step onto the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to.
If you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to. Keep thou my feet, I do not ask to see in the distance, seeing one step enough for me. And Bilbo is set when he sets out then on his journey to Rivendell. He says, I'm being swept off my feet. And that quote is on that sheet I gave out to you yesterday. So if any of you didn't get it, I've got a few more copies of it here. But don't worry about me. I'm finally being swept off my feet into the road, into the way that is calling, that is pulling him out. That little scene with Sam there, I love that one. This is the way you sort of get the same idea in the book. It's when Gandalf has elected Sam to be the one who will accompany Frodo. And Sam fell on his knees trembling. Get up, Sam, said Gandalf. I have thought of something better than that. Something that to shut your mouth and to punish you properly for eavesdropping. You shall go away with Mr. Frodo. Me, sir, cried Sam, springing up like a dog invited for a walk. Love that image. Me go to see the elves and all. Hooray, he shouted, and then he burst into tears. and you get that same feel in that scene, which is just delightful. If I take one more step, I will be further from home. And how often, I think all of us must in our lives, meet that moment where you think, if I take one more step, and you know how you said yesterday that fear, even as everybody bowed to them, and that fear and that excitement and that sense of adventure and all of that all wrapped up into one, and it's frightening. Ventures of which we cannot see the ending, through perils unknown, by paths as yet untrodden. So there's always the fear and the call going hand in hand. Have any of you, just take a moment now and think. Have you ever had a moment like that one? If I take one more step, you know you're making an irrevocable change in your destiny. Get married. You know,
thank
I
you.
Mean, we can all think of it. But think about that for a moment. Now, anybody want to share a moment they've had that if I take, yes?
The first time I came up here when I got on the boat.
Uh-huh. crossing the water, oh, there is a universal motif.
Well, getting on the boat wasn't so bad, but knowing I'd be coming up here and I just couldn't get in my car and drive home if I wanted to leave.
Yeah. One more step onto that boat and you're committed and there's no turning back. Yeah, no wonder crossing the water is a universal picture, you know, of setting out on this hero's adventure. When you cross the water, yeah, that one more step. Any others of times? Yes.
Joining the military, definitely.
That's got to be. Very definitely got to be. Yeah.
Pregnancy?
Huh?
Pregnancy?
Oh, and how? Yeah. Yeah, there's one. Boy, there's no turning back with that one. Yeah, Emily.
Well, this one, I think I can say this, but when a friend was very, very ill and I knew she was dying, that step into the room to know how to follow this journey through with her.
Yeah.
And that I didn't walk back out.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that commitment to that journey. That was a commitment to a journey.
Yeah, yeah. But I knew once I stepped in the door, I was there.
Yeah.
Still remember standing at the threshold.
Yeah. So. Just getting the courage to take that one more step.
Yeah.
One more step. Yeah. Yes.
The first time I went back to India without my family, it was going back to the same place, but it was without the family was a whole new experience.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. How old had you been?
I was 18.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that would be scary. Yeah. Right. Any of the rest of you have examples?
I can kind of say that for going to college in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're committing to a big change.
Sure.
And you don't know where it's going. I mean, that's the point. You're letting go of one thing without knowing what the next thing is going to be. Yeah, Carla, talking about thresholds this morning. Exactly, that threshold where you're on the edge between two things. Matthew Arnold, poem on Dover Beach. One world dead, the other unable to be born. Is that right? Did I get it right? Okay, I quoted it right. You know, it's that sense that you don't know where it is going.
Leaving the altar when you get married.
Yeah, yeah. That is definitely, you are stepping out now onto a new road. Exactly. Yeah. Well, now, this is what is happening then. This is the plot of the movie, really. I mean, they are getting rid of this ring of power. But every one of the characters in this movie is on this journey. And one other scriptural, we've talked about, mentioned Abraham and Sarah as an example of the journey. Can you think of other journeys in the Bible that might be models for us in scripture that the journey might be echoing?
Exodus?
Yes, the Exodus. Yes, most definitely. The people being called out to a new way of being in the world, being called out by God into the wilderness where they are going to be transformed, hopefully. It was a little difficult, but they were supposed to be transformed. So yes, certainly the Exodus, a major one. What other ones can you think of?
Joseph going to Egypt and being sold into slavery.
Yes, not a voluntary one. And sometimes they're not voluntary, are they? Sometimes we don't get a choice. We're drug out, kicking and screaming into a new way of being. Yeah. What else?
Naomi and Ruth.
Huh?
Naomi and Ruth.
Oh, yes. Nobody mentioned that one last week. Thank you. That is a beautiful one. Ruth setting out with those beautiful words that she speaks to her mother-in-law when she sets out into this new way of life. What else?
Paul, Road to Damascus.
Yes, yes, definitely, yeah. Yeah, you know what?
When the disciples decide to follow Jesus, the difference.
Absolutely. Follow me. I love the way Peter Jackson sort of uses and misuses the follow me thing. It makes such a lovely point. Yes, and they step out onto a road with Jesus, not knowing where they're going, and he doesn't tell them where they're going, does he? He just says, follow me. And that's what God said to Abraham, follow me to a place that I will show you. You know, he doesn't tell him where he's going. So, yeah, that's a perfect example. Yeah.
Yes. Just thinking of some of the resurrection narratives, you know, Mary Magdalene running from the tomb.
Yeah.
Disciples on the road to Emmaus. Just yeah. Resurrection stories.
Right, yeah, exactly, those all are, yeah. Yes?
Joseph and Mary fleeing to Egypt to save Jesus.
Yes, yeah.
To get away from trouble.
Right, right, yeah, that's yet another, yeah, there's... It's full of journeys, yes.
Aragorn's part kind of reminds me of Jacob going back to see Esau after he's been away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, he doesn't know the reception he's going to get, but he still has to go there to claim his.
Yeah. And that's a perfect one, Jacob going back at the edge of the river, wrestling with the angel. Because what happens to Jacob after he wrestles with that angel all night?
He has a new name.
He has a new name. We've already had that one. And what else? He limps into the sunrise. Has there ever been a better picture of the spiritual struggle? You know, we engage in it, and we're changed by it. Sometimes even sort of slightly crippled by it, ending up with a broken ankle or, you know, a bone out of joint. And we are changed irrevocably. We cannot go back to what we were before. And there's a lot made in The Lord of the Rings of Frodo saying, my journey is not like Bilbo's. He went there and back again. Frodo cannot go back again. He never goes back again. And so in the journey, we're irrevocably changed. And we don't go back. We may go home. And that's tomorrow's session, is going home and the whole idea of homecoming. But we are changed. So, which is a good segue into the next little set of clips.
As it was, a fourth age of Middle-earth began. In the fellowship of the ring, they were tightly bound by friendship and love, was ended. Found ourselves looking upon a familiar sight. We were home.
Pumpkin walks past him, he has to kind of wait for him. And I guess that kind of speaks to how none of the other hobbits really have any idea what they've done.
Yeah.
And they just have to act normal.
Yeah, all this life is going on as normal, and all this change is taking place. And and what else? What else do you see happening? Yes.
They know they're not the same people they were before, that they're detached somehow from the community that they used to be a part of.
Yeah, yeah. Another, T.S. Eliot. the wise men in the journey of the Magi, they go back to their old kingdoms, but no longer at home in the old dispensation, T.S. Eliot says.
And they're also connected to each other.
Yes.
Some very strong bonds.
Yeah, the very strong bond of community.
Through this experience.
Yeah, through this experience. But detached, no longer quite part of what's going on there. They can't quite just come back in as if nothing's happened. Everything has changed. Yeah.
Well, they do a lot more in the movie, and I like this a lot too, is when they come back, they're all definitely a lot more modest. Mm-hmm. You don't see Merry and Pippin hopping around with the fireworks and drinking a lot anymore.
Yeah.
Sam isn't, you know, stumbling around and mm-hmm. really clumsy and stuff. He's going up and he's asking her to marry him.
Uh-huh.
But what was kind of a little more in the books is when they come back and they see the whole place just like completely destroyed by Saruman's people.
Yeah.
They kind of take a little more of a leadership role, I think you could mm-hmm. say, in rebuilding the Shire.
Yes.
As a movie, I think it works more for them to not include that because it's kind of
yeah.
anticlimactic.
It's anticlimactic enough as it is,
yeah.
But yeah.
But
yeah.
I still really like that. Mm-hmm. You can see that, you know, instead of them just sitting around and having that same old, really simple life and just getting drunk and fat every day,
yeah.
When they go off for a year and they end up saving the world,
yeah.
They see the seriousness of everything, and when
yeah.
they see all the people of Rohan and Gondor uh-huh. and their other cultures, they
yeah.
learn a lot more, and it changes them a lot.
Yes. Yeah, and it is so much clearer, yeah, in the book,
mm-hmm.
and Gandalf even talks in very vocational kind of language to them, that, you know, he will be leaving them. It's sort of an ascension scene, really, that Gandalf is leaving, but they are now ready. They're now ready to lead others as he has led them, and they have learned their vocation in the world. Yeah, it's true. Anything else that sort of picked up on in that scene?
Well, I thought one of the best things that kind of illustrated what you just said
mm-hmm.
was their hesitation before they all picked up their beers and
yeah.
and cheered each other and drank. And you could, I thought it was just a great piece of acting and directing,
uh-huh.
but how their faces, you could see it in all their faces
yeah.
right before they drank. It really meant something.
Yeah, it did. And that toast was what, I mean, it was almost a, it was more than just a toast. It was a commitment to the future, a commitment to what they're now ready to do. So they make that commitment to go ahead into this new future at that point. So it's a real scene of covenant, maybe, of but anyway, dedicating them now themselves to this new vocation in the world. Now, there were some journeys we didn't mention when we were talking about some of the journeys in Scripture, and perhaps some of the more key, central ones, so key and central that maybe we don't think of them offhand. Can any of you think of what?
Jesus'
journey to Jerusalem, yes. Yeah, take up your cross and follow me, and we are all called on that journey to Jerusalem. And how would you define that journey? What is that? If you were to describe that journey, Jesus' journey to Jerusalem, what is going on? It's a journey. It's a phrase we use a lot. From death to life. A journey through death to life. And each one of the, I asked you yesterday to think about which were the Christ figures here and what made them Christ figures. Each one of the characters goes through, and it's clear in the book, it's not absolutely clear in the film, so don't go struggling and thinking, why am I so dumb I can't see it? It's not necessarily there in the movie. Some of it's there by implication, but it's definitely there in the book, that each one of the characters does journey through death to life. Oh, yeah, in some sense or another, even including Boromir, but, you know, that it is a journey from death to life and a new way of living in the world, and so that is the central journey of the Scripture, and Jesus' journey, the cross, the road to Jerusalem is the physical aspect of it, but it is a journey through death to life. And so each of the characters do. So thinking about vocation, we've seen the vocation, how would you describe, which figures here, which of the main characters would you see as Christ figures in some way? Because as I said, this is not an allegory, so there's no one thing equals this one thing. There's a whole lot of references that we can find. And so what references do you find?
Oh, yes. Gandalf.
Yes.
Sure.
Most definitely. In what sense?
That, is it the Mines of Moria?
Yes.
So he enters in and is lost.
Yeah.
Through death and then later rises.
Yeah,
basically.
He's the most clearly dying and rising figure in the book and in the movie. And he harrows the gates of hell,
yes.
in essence, by pursuing that demon into the depths, the very chasm of hell, really, pursuing the demon. So Gandalf, most definitely, I like to think of him really as Jesus in the Gospel of John somewhat, you know, this idea of coming down and going up and everything. But you had one too?
I think that Aragorn's the most obvious one, because he's, he's kind of seizing his responsibility, and he's... kind of inspiring a whole race of people to move forward and be confident about the future and to be free again.
Yeah, he's the once and future king thing, you know, and he's the kingship side of Jesus. Jesus establishing the new reign of God, and Aragorn establishes the new reign. What qualities does he have that you would see as being Christ-like too? I mean, obviously this idea of the king and starting a new form of kingdom. Other qualities, yes?
He has the hands of a healer.
The hands of a healer, yes. This is talked about a lot. The hands of the king are the hands of a healer. He is a healer, yeah. Yes?
He's very humble, and he initially doesn't want the responsibility and power that has been given to him.
Yeah. He struggles with his vocation. He absolutely struggles with it, especially in the movie. I mean, and the movie kind of exaggerated that. I think some have commented on it. It kind of exaggerated that. But he does struggle with his vocation, and he is not, you know, does not grasp at power. He's not grasping for power. He is humble in his use of it. He is a servant. It's another thing. The idea of the servant of the, as king is very strong in Aragorn. And just some of the physical aspects of him. How does he come onto the scene? How does he enter the story?
As a stranger,
a homeless person, really. You know, the foxes have holes, the birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He's very literally that in the beginning of the book. He is, you're looking at him, you would not think he was a king. They take him for a vagabond. So he's sort of this whole idea, and you see it in stories throughout the world, this king in disguise. No one recognizes him. He's the king in disguise, and he turns out to be. In so much as you have, you know, found to be the least of these, you know, he appears to be the least of these. So there's a lot of Christ-like aspects, certainly about Aragorn and about Gandalf. Yes, Joe?
In the Two Towers, I think it was, when he went down to the ghostly, the ghost place, that's kind of like how Jesus went through, And he interacted with the dead.
Yeah, the paths of the dead. He very literally it's very literalized in the book and the movie, the paths of the dead. So that is his going through death to life, through going through the paths of the dead, yeah. And Gimli and also the elf, Legolas, they too go on that path through death to life. And I should have looked it up. There's Gimli later describes going through death to life, and he talks about it in exactly those terms, going through death to life, yeah. Okay, so who haven't we mentioned?
Frodo,
okay, and so how is he a Christ figure?
I see, like, a really close parallel between the Council of Elrond and Paradise Lost, when God's up in heaven saying, who will go down and save humanity, and Jesus says, I'll go.
Send me, I will go, yeah, I'll go. And I like when Frodo says, though I do not know the way. I just love that line. I will go, though I do not know the way. Yeah. So, yes, that he is the chosen, the elected one to go. And what does he do? I mean, it's very theological terms of what his task is. What is his task?
Salvation.
Salvation, yeah. Though it's very clear in the book that, you know, by destroying this ring, they haven't wiped out evil from the world. And Sauron is only a servant of Melkor, the actual Satan figure in Tolkien's mythology, that Sauron is only a servant of Melkor. Oh, yeah, we still got 5 minutes, down.
Yeah.
Loads of time. So, but what physically, literally, does Frodo do that very much echoes what Christ does?
Carries a cross.
Yeah, in this case, it's the ring. And he carries it to the top of a mountain. So he carries the weight, and it's described as being very, very heavy, isn't it? He's carrying the weight of sin that is focused on that ring. And okay, we can't equate that ring with any one story, one source of evil in the world. There's a focus of evil, and it's different for every person. Somebody was talking to me about that yesterday. Who was talking about that? What this ring, this focus of evil, is different for every person. But he carries the weight of that, the weight of sin, to the top of this mountain so that it might be destroyed. So he is well and truly the suffering servant. And this is, you know, made very, very explicit in the book. And in fact, Tolkien has tied the whole calendar of when this happens, and the events are tied to the Christian calendar. And that's not too obvious unless you read it very carefully. And furthermore, you can't even use the modern calendar to do it. You've got to go back to the old calendar before our calendar, too, and it's all tied. And there is very definitely a Good Friday and an Easter Sunday, and all of that is very, very literal in the book. So he ties it very strictly. So Frodo is so obviously the you know, the Christ figure in that regard, of this destruction of this force of evil in the world, and as the suffering servant. There's one more big one that no one's mentioned.
Sam.
Hmm?
Sam.
Sam. Sam, is that what you were going to say too?
Yeah.
And why is Sam a Christ figure?
Well, I was just thinking, like, near the end, when they're, like, both really tired and they're trying to get to the top of the mountain,
uh-huh.
He sacrifices so much for Frodo. Like, he gives him his water, he, like, offers mm-hmm. to carry him,
mm-hmm.
offers to carry the ring, he does all that.
He is the servant, the prototypical servant throughout, and everything he does is to serve another. So yes, somebody else mentioned Sam too. What were you going to say? Somebody else said Sam. What aspect of Sam is? What else does he do that sort of we can think of God in these terms? What is Sam before he goes on his journey to this new vocation? What is
gardener.
He's a gardener. Well, you know, God planted a garden in Eden. And then I love, of course, the parable in the New Testament about the gardener and the landowner and the gardener coming and the tree that does not bear fruit and the gardener saying, oh, but let me work on it for another year. And whenever I preach on that, I always say, you know, well, what do you suppose the gardener said next year when the fig tree didn't bear fruit? Please let me work on it another year. You know, so it's God the gardener, the nurturer, and Sam is the nurturer. He is the servant par excellence in this story. So all of them Christ figures. And of course we can see even in Mary and Frodo and the rest, you know, that in some ways, following this vocation, you know, in some ways, we are all called to be little Christ. And so to all be Christ figures in some way, I mean, that's what we're called to be in the world. And so all of them are in some way in this journey they are on, in this new vocation that they find. We really don't have time for any more seeds. I had a couple of more that, you know, Frodo, after he gets back to the Shire and unable to go on, you know, what do you do when everything has changed, when you cannot come back, when there is no coming back. And so he is so utterly changed, like Jacob limping into the sunrise, so utterly changed and by his journey that there is no going back. You can't go home again. It was not there and back again in some way. So any other comments or questions? I think we are right at 5 o'clock. There's so much here, and I don't yet, so anyone, we haven't even, and I haven't put it into the schedule, put in discussing evil in this and what we do with evil. And it's such an important discussion. But, you know, if any of you between now and tomorrow have any thoughts about evil and the role of evil and how you see evil being dealt with in this, We'll certainly take a few minutes to talk about that too. And the other aspect we're not talking about is kind of the literary aspect of and it figures very greatly in the story, of Tolkien's whole concept of story and the role of story in our lives and how important story is. And so those are two aspects we haven't specifically worked into our schedule. But if you have any comments or questions or thoughts on that, I'll take a few moments to talk about that tomorrow too. So, any other questions? Well, thank you, and I'm just longing. I said I have an ulterior motive in doing this, and that was my ulterior motive in wanting to do this, that I love to talk about this, and I've never found anybody to talk about with the way I want. So, if anybody wants to talk about this, please.
Why don't you schedule it's in a downtime, like in Chalet 2 living room or something.
Yeah,
people
we sure
can come
could.
By and
just come
talk
and
about
talk
it.
Without a schedule. Yeah, maybe we could do that. We'll look for an opportunity. yeah, that would be good. Just and stay now if you want to. If you're starving to death, ready for your.